Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including iTunes, the Stitcher Radio app for your smart device, CairoRadio.com, and the all-new Adore Network at Adore.fm. Let's get started with the episode. Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 275 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight to your ear holes! Came up a little quicker than I expected. Okay, here we go. Oh, man. We've got a great episode planned for you this week. Grammy-winning percussionist and comic book writer, musician thing, T.J. Troy. T.J. Troy is going to be gracing us with his presence on this here episode of the Air Raid Podcast. This took place a couple of months ago. TJ was kind enough to come up from LA and come into the backyard and chat with us for a little while about this new project that he's working on called Run Down Hill. It's a band that accompanies a comic book. Albums that accompany a comic book that you listen to the album while you read the book. And it's quite fascinating. Also, he shares with us how he came to win a Grammy. Yeah, that's right. A Grammy-winning percussionist, man, was right here in the backyard joining me in a wonderful, wonderful little chat. So we'll get to all that stuff in a moment. Actually, let's talk about it right now. The comic book is called Spurs, and he's working with an artist called Chris McFan, who draws like Spider-Man and stuff for Marvel Comics. And it's just, I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful comic book. And they've got albums that come with the book that you can listen to while you read through, man. And it's really cool. It's a great idea. And they're doing these live shows where they basically have these, you know, kind of like animations going on while they're playing the music. And it's pretty fascinating. Pretty fascinating, cool idea. So TJ Troy, I'm a little bit into my cups, folks. And here's why. Because right now, as you listen to this, I am going to be in Palm Springs, California, on vacation with my family. I'm probably going to be in a pool and a bit into my cups there as well. So we're just trying to, I've only done two episodes tonight. But man, it's taken a lot out of me. It's taken a lot out of me here already. I still got a pack. It's already 8 p.m. I had a long day at my day job, and now I'm here just doing this, getting this stuff ready so I can just be on vacation, right? The only thing I have to do while I'm on vacation is just post the show. So I'm just making sure that all of this stuff is just done, planned out, ready to rock, right? Yeah. Anyway, we're going to have a great conversation with TJ Troy. Man, why is that so difficult to say? Oh, my God. TJ, if you're listening to this, I apologize, sir. Okay. So right now, I'm in Palm Springs. What am I going to be doing when this show goes up? Like I said, there's a pool right outside the front door. of this place that I'm going to. We went to this certain place last year with my family. It's in a retirement community, if you can believe that. I'm only 35, and we're going to a retirement community, and it's the best thing ever, man. Seriously. It is the greatest vacation that I think I've ever taken. It is so, there's so much non-commitment that is required for a vacation like this. Excuse me. Yeah, we're going to a condo that a cousin of mine owns, and we're just going to stay in this retirement community and just chill, man. And my parents are going to be there, so we got free babysitters just built in right into the vacation. And we're just going to chill in the pool, soak up some sun, and, like I said, get into our cups. So that's probably what I'm doing right now. Maybe I'm picking limes off one of the many lime trees and making ceviche, which I did last year, which turned out really, really good. Or just walking around the campus of this sprawling mid-century modern retirement community where nobody is out for some reason. Maybe it's just the off-season or something like that, but it's like super hot down there right now. We're into November. And I think it gets pretty warm down there, like it was last year. And there's just nobody out and about in this whole community, which is enormous. And so we've usually got the pool to ourselves, which is amazing. And if there are people there, I'm not worried about what I look like with my clothes off, or just, you know, not with all my clothes off, it just being in my shorts. Which is great because, you know, it's just a bunch of like 60 and 70 year olds just lounging by the pool, maybe an 80 year old, you know, sprinkled in. They don't care what I look like. They don't care about my misshapen body. And I don't care about theirs. So it's all good, man. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So I just go swim with my daughters a little bit drunk. Is that a bad that's kind of a bad thing to say, right? I'm going to get drunk, go swim with my daughters. Oh man, I am so looking forward to this. Oh my God, you guys don't even understand. I need a break. I need a break from just being here in the city. I need it. I need it. I need it. I need it. And we're leaving tomorrow after work. I'm recording this on a Tuesday. On a Monday, we're leaving a Tuesday night, and I just need to get this episode done. I need to pack, and then it's going to be smooth sailing, man. Just one more day of work, and then smooth sailing, and getting on a plane with two very small children, and that's no fun, actually. That's not, I'm not even going to think about that. I'm not even going to think about it. Okay, let's, let's get on to business, shall we? Like we've been mentioning in the past two episodes, we will be changing the RSS feed. The RSS feed is where you get the show from if you're using like a third party pod catching app on your mobile device. We're going to be changing that over to the Spreaker feed because we are now part of the Spreaker network, Adore, right? You guys know about this, right? Yeah, Adore.fm. It's a great, great new network, podcasting network that we are a part of, and we are very happy that we are a part of it. Things are going well, but we need to get everything kind of switched over to their whole platform, even though we still are over on CairoRadio.com, so you can still get it there as well. But if you're subscribed to our RSS feed, the current one that is at our website at air-raid.net, that will be changing soon, and you will have to, and I'm sorry about this, I'm sorry about the inconvenience, but you will have to resubscribe to that RSS feed because it will no longer be updated, okay? Coming in about a week or so. So what's going to happen is if you want to get a jump on this, the Spreaker RSS feed is already up. You can go to adore.fm, click on the Air Raid podcast, go to our Spreaker page, and the RSS feed is right there for your pleasure, okay? You can just click on that and resubscribe to the show. We're going to be changing the RSS feed at air-raid.net. The link to that is going to be the new Spreaker RSS feed. This is all taking way too long. But we just want to make sure you guys have this all taken care of, right? We don't want to lose anybody, and we don't want anybody to not know what's going on. So that's what's happening. So we got a week left with our current RSS feed. So go ahead and just get switched over to the Spreaker one right now, or you can wait until it's too late and then have to do it when you don't know what's going on. Okay? All right. So there's the spiel, guys. Okay, we're going to be featuring music today on this here episode, episode 275. Can you believe it? Oh, my God, we've been doing this show for so long. We're going to be featuring music by the band Run Downhill, of which TJ Troy is the singer and the drummer of. And Run Downhill makes this music for the comic books Spurs, which is kind of like a Western, I don't know, Western thriller or something like that. I don't know, man. I haven't really read it yet, but I'm taking it with me to Palm Springs and going to read through these two books that TJ Troy left me. They're beautiful, beautiful books. And they come with these CDs with all the music on it, man, that you can listen to while you're reading it. And the music goes along with the storyline. So if you'd like to get yourself a copy, you can go to rundownhillmusic.com and order it there. I believe TJ also during the episode talks about how else you can get it and where you can see them coming up and everything like that. So, okay, so we're going to be featuring music, like I said, from Run Downhill during this episode. This one's called A Killer, and we'll be right back with more of the Ear Raid Podcast for your ears with special guest this week, Grammy-winning percussionist TJ Troy. All right, A Killer by Run Downhill. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us.
Gun knows no conscience. The steel, the black powder won't be in my way. So I defer.
Comic book has started. Have you guys done like a lot of the comic cons?
I've gone a lot as an attendee.
Yeah.
I have not had a table until last weekend at Long Beach Comic Con.
Yeah.
And then this weekend at Rose City. So I wanted to hit the ground running on this. You know, it's the first time exhibiting, but it was a chance to exhibit along with Chris, who drew this book. So we shared the table together.
Right.
And
I recognize that name too. What else does he draw for?
Chris,
he do stuff for like Marvel.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
He's been an industry professional for almost two decades now.
And you grew up with that guy,
yeah.
Right?
We
he's
all
a Wenatchee,
he's
Washington,
another Wenatchee, Washington dude, man. I met Chris in the sixth grade. We used to skateboard together. We played Dungeons and Dragons together.
Yeah.
Read comics together. And then we played in the high school band and middle school band and everything. He's a trumpet player.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you guys just really just stayed away from girls at all costs.
Pretty much, dude.
I was in the same boat, man. I just say, you know, poking fun where fun needs to be poked.
Exactly. I mean, at a certain point, I stopped doing as much of the Dungeons and Dragons type of stuff. I had a crew of guys, and we did our thing, and there was D&D in there, and there was comic books and magic cards and all of that. But as I got older, into high school especially, music became more and more of a focus until you know, I knew music was going to become a career for me probably when I was in the fifth or sixth grade. I
mean, did you start? Okay, so TJ Troy joining me here in the backyard. Percussionist.
Yes.
Comic book writer.
Mm-hmm.
Voiceover actor.
Indeed.
Right?
Indeed.
And you're up here from where do you live now? LA?
Los Angeles, yeah.
Los Angeles, California. You've got this new, we should say, you've got this new comic book out called Running Downhill, or Run Downhill.
Yeah, Run Downhill is both the name of the band and the comic book.
Right, so music goes along with it.
Indeed.
And so you're basically taking like two parts of your favorite worlds and mashing them together.
You know, and if people could say that about their lives, I think the world would be a better place.
Everybody would be a lot happier.
A lot happier,
right?
Man.
Yeah,
for sure.
Totally.
Yeah.
Oh man, I lost my train of thought. But did you start when you started music? Were you starting as like a drummer?
I started playing music when I was 4 years old.
Four?
And it did start
on
the drum set.
Yeah. Come on.
I was so little, man, my feet could not even reach the pedals. I would sit up on the stool, and I have three older brothers.
Yeah.
I have a grandfather who was a semi-professional drummer around the Seattle area. He used
really?
To play with the Jay Curtis Dance Band back in the 50s.
Yeah?
50s, no, probably 60s, actually. The Troy family originated in Sioux City, Iowa, which is where my father was from.
Uh-huh.
They moved out to the Seattle area in, you know, late 50s, early 60s, somewhere in there. My grandfather had taken a new position teaching. And, you know, my mom and dad went to Blanchett High School. And so they're Seattleites.
Shit. Yeah, right down the road.
Right down the road. Here. And then my dad went to Seattle University. They enlisted in the Army. My dad was a commissioned officer in the Army for a long time. And then roundabout, you know, a whole career later, they end up in Wenatchee, Washington.
Yeah.
Which is where I grew up.
Did your dad go to Vietnam?
Yeah, he served.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Doing what?
He was the captain of a field hospital.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
That's an intense job.
Yeah, and he was in country maybe just a month, maybe 2 months or something like that, and he was wounded.
Uh-huh.
And then you know, came back stateside and stayed in the military for a long time, and then decided that his career was going to take him elsewhere and moved into hospital administration, which is where, you know, his entire career existed.
Uh-huh.
And he was very, very talented at what he did, and you know, had a fantastic career, and now they are happily retired. They live in Aberdeen, Washington now, and they have a slew of grandchildren that they love to dote
nice,
on. We're a very close family. We really stay connected to one another, and music was definitely one of the things that...
So did your dad play?
He sang.
Oh, okay. He was a singer. Mom? And what about mom?
Mom liked to sing. She also liked to dance. She was a very skilled dancer. And that's really where the love of music sort of originated, was from the parents.
Sure, it was just in the house.
Yeah, it was in the house. And our grandfather also being a drummer. So then my oldest brother, I'm the youngest of six kids, by the way.
Six?
Yeah, big family.
Holy smokes.
So my oldest brother, who's 10 years older than I am, he decided he wanted to play the drums.
Yeah.
So the drum set comes into the house. So what do the younger three brothers want to do?
Well, yeah.
We all want to play the drums, you know? So any moment that we had to sneak into the room and get some time on the kit, we took it.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally, I was 4 years old. My feet are dangling off the stool. I can't reach the pedals. And then I remember distinctly there was a point when I could reach the pedals, and then I couldn't play all of a sudden.
Right.
And I had to reteach myself the four-limb coordination and you know, so in the early years, it was all self-taught.
So was Grandpa, like, given lessons?
No. No.
He didn't want to do that.
Well, he loved to talk about it.
I can't even imagine what it would be like to give, like, a four-year-old drum lessons, man.
It was nothing like that.
I've got a four-year-old right now, and it is, like, I mean, just trying to have her put together a 20-piece puzzle.
Yep.
is like
or trying to get
hair.
A sandwich down without it getting all over the face. I mean, that's
exactly
those are the challenges of the 4-year-old faces.
Yeah, see, I bought her this little red Stratocaster right here. Barely fits her body, but she's pretty stoked on that thing.
But it's got Superman and Wonder Woman shoulder strap.
Well, right? it's all ladies.
Justice League.
Yeah, it's all ladies.
Oh, it's Supergirl.
It's Wonder Woman and it's Batwoman.
Nice.
Or is it Batgirl? I can't remember.
There's Batgirl and Batwoman. They're two different characters behind the mask.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
It originated with Batgirl. She was the first character to emerge, and then probably about 10 years ago, they introduced Batwoman as her
own
character.
Like she's grown up.
Well, I mean,
if
you really want to talk about the progress of Batgirl, it's a hellacious story. The original Batgirl was Barbara Gordon in a story called The Killing Joke, written by Alan Moore. She was shot through the spine by the Joker and was paralyzed from the waist down.
What year
down.
Was that?
That was 1990, late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, that seems pretty dark to be 1960s.
Yeah. It was definitely, is in the period what we call the revisionist period, where the comic writers went back to revise all of these popular characters.
Right.
And put more of a modern spin onto things. Like, Alan Moore and Frank Miller were really the two guys that stand out from that period as we're gonna shake things up, we're gonna change stuff.
Now, was that about the time, because I remember in the 90s, you're a little bit older than I am, but I remember in the 90s when there was a total resurgence in comic books.
This is this would be before that. The revisionist
when Image Comics came out, and it was super dark stuff, super bloody, super gory, showed some nipple.
Right.
You know,
the dig with Image Comics is it was all creators and the founders of that imprint of Image Comics company, Todd McFarlane, Rob Liefeld, Jim Lee. These were the guys who decided we're stepping away from the big two, Marvel and DC, because they won't let us own the characters. We've been drawing Spider-Man this whole time. Well, I got a character that I want to put out on Marvel, and they said
we
own the properties, and if you put out a character, we're going to own the character. And they said, we don't want you to do that. So Tom McFarlane, those guys, they stepped away. Tom McFarlane started Spawn, which became immensely popular.
Yes. Jim was that Lee, in the 90s?
That was the 90s.
That was 90s that when Spawn came out. Okay.
And then that also, that period actually in the 90s, that was the darkest period in my mind of the comic book industry, okay? Because that's when the industry decided to say, what we're going to do, we're going to put out a new X-Men number one, except there's going to be 6 different covers of it.
Yeah.
Because there was this notion that you could collect comic books and in 10 years they would have increased in value and that would pay for your college tuition.
Right. Yeah.
And you literally had people say that, like, I got X-Men number one, my college is taken care of. And it's just a bunch of nonsense. I mean, if you have 100,000 copies of a book that's published, it's worth nothing. It's if you have one copy of X-Men that exists.
Yeah.
That's worth something.
That's why the old ones are worth it.
Exactly. I mean, the first issue of Action Comics last year got auctioned off for how many millions of dollars, dude?
I heard about that. Like it was insane. It was like 2.5 or maybe even 3.5 or something like that. It was nuts.
It was a ridiculous amount of money. Because it's so rare and it was in such great condition. There's other copies of that book that exist, they're in crummy condition.
Right. Nobody took care of it.
Yeah. This one was very well taken care of. It was sealed in a bag, kept away from the light so that it didn't decay.
Right.
And that's why it was worth so much from a collector's standpoint. You know, it's similar to baseball cards. You know, like, you ever hear the story of the Honus Wagner card?
No, I don't even know who that is.
Okay.
I was never even in the baseball. The only reason that I got into comic books was because I thought at the time that I was a kid, and I was probably, I don't know, maybe 11, maybe 12 or something like that. And I had this big thing of baseball cards, right? Hated baseball. But I thought that's what I was supposed to fucking do, right? I was supposed to. All my friends were collecting baseball cards, so I collected baseball cards too, along with Dick Tracy cards.
Yeah,
the movie, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles,
right on,
and X-Men cards.
There you go.
But then I traded my big box of baseball cards to a kid for his big box of comic books.
That's a good trade.
Depending it was a great trade, man.
Depending
and
on
I totally,
what books were in there, though.
Well, right? There was a lot of shit.
Did you
there
read
was a
them?
Lot of shit in there. Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. And I still do. Like, they're up in the garage right now.
Yeah.
In a big old Tupperware box. But I take them down from time to time and, mm-hmm. and flip through some of them, you know. But there was like a ton of like Transformers in there and like a lot of stuff that was not great.
Dude, you would be shocked how the Transformer titles now.
Yeah?
How popular they actually are.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Because I've got a ton of really old Transformers comics.
You know, you'd be surprised just to look through and see what you have, because you never know. You may have one of those diamonds in the rough.
Yeah.
You know?
How about G.I. Joe? Does anybody want G.I. Joe comic books out there? Because
they still
I got a
publish,
ton of those.
They publish G.I. Joe still. They publish Transformers. In fact, the same company publishes yeah. those two titles called IDW. Mm. And they use characters that they license off from
okay.
Hasbro. So
oh.
they have the relationship with Hasbro. They don't have any creator-owned content at IDW, although I think that's going to change if it hasn't changed already. They're very interested in taking on creator-owned content,
huh.
but
huh.
it's usually licensed content. So they publish Transformers. They do
yeah,
G.I.
Yeah.
Joe. They do. I got one from... it wasn't IDW. It was a different company called Dynamite. They did Voltron versus Robotech.
Yeah, see, I've got some mentioned. Of those, too.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. yeah, yeah.
They, but IDW did put out Gem.
Gem.
Truly outrageous.
Oh, yeah.
There's a Gem comic
totally.
Book right now. Absolutely.
Really?
Oh,
oh
yeah.
because the movie's coming back
uh-huh.
out, right?
The movie's
they're
coming back out. And they're going to revamp the cartoon. I mean,
oh, sure.
These are all product pushes, and they you know contextualize everything together to really cater to
oh, yeah.
that
yeah.
age group.
Well, you're seeing it with like Star Wars right now, man. Like
yep.
the all the you know action figures are coming out before the movie is coming out.
Oh, yeah.
We've got all these, you know, a series of comic books now that are coming out that are
mm-hmm.
supposed to be taking place in between.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's they're saying that's the official canon now
yep.
Of the Star Wars story.
I'll do a little plug for a buddy of mine who owns
yeah.
Golden Apple Comics, and that's where this t-shirt came from.
Oh, nice.
And this was a package deal I got at the Long Beach Comic Con, because
uh-huh.
I know the guys at Golden Apple Comics. They're my friends.
Yeah, yeah.
But they had a special book that was published, and the cover, the
We're
variant...
We're talking Star Wars.
Yeah, Star Wars. And it's a lead-up to The Force Awakens.
Okay.
And the cover for that was created especially for the Golden Apple store.
Okay, so it's after...
Only for
it's
Long
after
Beach Comic Con.
Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm. So it's leading up to The Force Awakens, and so that cover was drawn exclusively for Golden Apple Comics for
oh,
the
cool.
store.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, maybe, you know, a couple hundred of those that have been printed.
Where's that
know.
One at? Where's the store at?
It's down in Los Angeles.
Los
That's
Angeles?
The shop
okay.
that I go to.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Those are my friends. I've known them for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I have a pull box there, so I get my subscriptions that come into that box, and that's where I get my
yeah.
monthly titles, dude. You know, it's a whole culture.
I fucking
you know
love
what I'm
it,
saying?
Man. No, I love going into comic book stores because, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm more into, like, looking at the little figures and figurines
yep.
and stuff now more
oh, yeah.
than I am the books
mm-hmm.
for some reason. I mean, there will be some books that I actually really get into, but not so much anymore.
Yeah.
But has that always been a thing for you then?
You know, when I was really little, it was a treat. To get
yeah.
for Christmas, like a Superman comic book, like,
sure.
or a Green Lantern comic book, and I didn't even know who Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams were doing Green Lantern.
I don't know who those
Green
are.
Arrow.
Those like are, those are the artists.
Well, those are the writers, creator team,
oh, okay.
writer artist
gotcha.
Team.
Gotcha.
That were you know Denny O'Neil was really responsible for a lot of what Batman is today.
Right.
Those guys are responsible for. Green Lantern, Green Arrow
mm-hmm.
being who they are today. And in fact, those two guys, they did something really bold in the 70s. They decided that Green Arrow's sidekick, Speedy, they were going to make him addicted to heroin. And
what?
Yeah, I'm not even kidding. They made him this teenage sidekick, and they got
yeah.
him addicted to heroin. Why?
Perfect.
So that they could tell the story of discovering this addiction.
Sure.
And then doing something to pull him out of that. Like,
is that Green, where his powers came from?
Well, I mean, he doesn't
the heroin
have,
addiction.
He doesn't have the powers so much as he has
yeah.
a skill set. Like Green Arrow has a skill set. He's not a powered individual.
Oh, I was thinking of Green Lantern.
Yeah, Green Lantern.
Okay.
I mean, his powers come from the ring, obviously.
Come from the ring.
Right.
Yep. yep.
Green Arrow is just a trained individual, and
gotcha.
His sidekick is kind of the same thing.
All right.
But that was one of the first comic books from the 70s that did not have the approved by the Comics Code stamp on the cover.
Okay.
And they didn't know, how is this going to fly?
Yeah,
is this
yeah.
going to be okay? And sure enough, not only was it okay, it was a big hit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people like when you tell them the truth.
Right.
And people respect you because they feel that they're being respected. You're not pandering to a specific audience and saying that
everything
is... Yeah,
it's not like Captain America where it's just like, you know, he can do everything. No. And he's the most humble and most honorable, you know, picture of American citizen.
Right.
You
know? But so that's that helped along this wave of trying to humanize the concept of the superhero.
Right.
And make it more relatable to people like you and I.
Sure.
And... Of course, it is relatable, so then we're able to get into the stories and buy more of the comics.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, it's all sort of one hand washing another. They respect the audience respects the characters.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's fast forward up until now, where you see the comic book industry actually being on the cutting edge of, you know, more social equalization discussions. You know,
sure,
how do we make everybody have an equal voice within everything? So what do they do? Thor is now a woman. It's the first time that we've had a female Thor, because the hammer of Thor can be wielded by anybody who possesses the values and the qualities. And that doesn't need to be a man. It can be a woman.
Sure.
It could also be an alien species. If they possess the values of Thor, they too can wield the hammer. So that's where we're at right now with that character. You know what I'm saying?
Are people pissed? Like, I mean, I'm sure in certain circles it's just like they don't want anything to change because this is what they've loved since they were a kid, right?
It's a comfort thing.
It's a comfort
food.
Like,
why would you mess with Batman and make Bruce Wayne not be Batman? Why would you ever do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Grant Morrison did that a couple of years ago. He killed Bruce Wayne.
Right.
Killed, in quotes, right?
Yeah.
Bruce Wayne's back as Batman. He didn't stay dead for very long. But when that happened, the writer, Grant Morrison, literally was receiving death threats.
Yeah.
He was, you know, opening up his mail and people saying, I'm gonna kill you. You fucked with Batman. Why did you do that? And, you know, dude, take a step back from it and look at this in a longer timeline. Wouldn't it be more interesting if your hero defeated death itself? Doesn't that make him more... Like, more of a legend in your eyes? Take a step back and let the story
Have you
be
ever been
told.
That type of person, though, that has taken this stuff a little bit too seriously?
You know, I have emotional connections to certain characters, but more to
Like, who's a character if somebody fucked with that character that you would get pissed?
I wouldn't really get pissed. I'm a big Batman fan.
Yeah.
I love Batman. Yeah. And honestly, when Grant Morrison started doing that, I was kind of like, you know what, man, hell with you type of thing. But then, like I was saying, you take a step back and let the dude actually tell his story.
Right.
Because 6 months down the line comes the story called The Return of Bruce Wayne.
Right, right.
And man, that was a riveting story.
Yeah. It was like the whole Superman versus Doomsday thing, man. I remember when that came out.
I had
where
that
they killed
issue.
Off. When they killed off, I've got all of them.
I've got all that. I still have mine bagged in the black bag.
In the white?
Bag.
Oh, you got the black bag?
The black bag. It has a black armband that's like the memorial. Like, I'm going to wear the armband black with the Superman shield on it to honor his death. But
I think
here's,
I have that one. Didn't it come with that white bag, too, or something like that?
That was the resurrection. That's when he came back.
Bitch. Yeah.
You know, the wild thing about all the bagging. This is what happened in the comics industry. I was referring to this in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what caused the bubble of the comic book industry to burst, is they got gluttonous. And they said, you know what? We're going to do 5 different covers of Superman dying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're going to put them in bags. The bags ended up having a really high acid content and were destroying the comic books inside them.
Really?
So everyone says, you got to keep it sealed or it's not a collectible anymore.
If you
kept it sealed, it destroyed the book.
Yeah.
So people...
So you just end up with a bag of dust.
Kind of. There was one company
sealed.
Who said, you know, whoever sends us the most of these bullshit, you know, polyurethane bags or whatever they were, whoever sends us the most that you've pulled your comics out of to save your comic book and you kept the bag, put that in an envelope and send to us. Whoever sends us the most, we're going to give you a prize. And it's like a bitchin', like super rare signed comic book by an artist.
Oh, nice.
Or like a piece of art or something.
That's awesome.
You know, but even in that... That's a beautiful thing because that's still a connection with your audience. It starts that dialogue.
Sure.
And that's
sure.
one of the beautiful things about the comic book industry is at the forefront of it, you have the creators who interface directly with the fans. And that's you know, Chris and I were doing at the Rose City Comic Con this last weekend. And I did that, you know, down at Long Beach the weekend before with our new book, is actually having the time to interact directly with the fan base and get face-to-face time.
Yeah.
In the music industry, and I've been seeing this, and it's just given me food for thought for a while and cause to pause and really consider what's going on in the music industry. That level of fan interaction doesn't happen unless the fan chooses to come to a live performance.
Right. Yeah.
And that's essentially what the Comic-Con becomes, except the Comic-Con is an all-day, 10-hour event.
Right,
and
right.
You walk from table to table, and people, like, you know, I was behind the table all day, and people come up, and I give them my pitch, and I tell them what my book is about.
Right.
And I show them the cool things. This comes with a CD in the back. The music is cross-contextualized with the stories. They go together. Here's this threefold product line that it's a book, it's a CD, it's a motion comic video where the song comes together. And then we project those videos live when we play. So our stage show is a multimedia.
So are you
stage
playing?
Show.
Are you playing shows at these at the Comic Cons?
Not at the cons yet.
No,
I need to you know make more relationships with the people organizing the conventions. But it's something I really want to do, and I know that the convention people would love to have it because it's so unique and so different.
Yeah,
it's just a matter of building those relationships.
Oh yeah, and, for sure.
You
for
know,
sure. And you're only 2 issues in, right?
So far, two main issues. This project,
How do you even fucking put out something like this by yourself? I don't even understand how that happens.
You know, it's a labor of love.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of the thing that carries it through. And it's a vision that I really believe strongly in. It's something I decided to do a few years ago, and then I decided to come hell or high water.
So this was your idea. You thought up this concept. You wanted to make something that went along with some sort of soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. It was more like I was writing a set of songs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's the origin of Run Downhill.
Yeah.
I'm going to lay it out for you. I was working with the Chamber Music Group. I've been a professional musician now for, you know, 20 years.
Yeah.
And my career as a freelancer necessitates that I go out and play with a multitude of different groups. So as a performer, my skill set lies primarily with, world percussion, orchestral percussion instruments. I do play drum set, you know, so these worlds all together make me a marketable individual as a performer.
Being a drummer in general has to make you pretty fucking marketable, you know, man.
and drummer with a lot of training and a lot of experience and a great passion for the gig, you know, and I want to show the music that, you know, means so much to me. So we have passionate people that, That makes for a good worker. You know what I'm saying? but at the time, this was a few years ago, I was playing with the Chamber Music Group.
Mm-hmm.
It was flute, clarinet, guitar, and percussion.
Yeah.
And by this point in our evolution, I was doing a large part of the music direction. You know, I was writing a lot of music for it. I was choosing other pieces of repertoire either to arrange or, choosing pieces that would work for that instrumentation. And that's a strange instrumentation. There's not a lot of music written specifically for that. There are some things, but I was writing a lot of music for the group, and I started to generate this repertoire. Actually, it came off of a telephone conversation with my brother. He and I were talking. He lives here in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
And he and I were talking, why don't we do something together? That'd be fun.
Yeah.
And as soon as I put the phone down, I pick up the guitar and start writing some music. And it started to generate this repertoire that was really different from anything else in this chamber music group. But I didn't have any other outlet at the time for
Well, so was it something that, like, were you thinking about, like, because this all, the we should say that Run Downhill kind of takes place in, what, the Old West?
Yeah.
Almost like a Western kind of setting?
Yeah, it's 1870s, post-Civil War, Reconstruction, Western United States, although it's a fictional town.
Well, sure. Yeah. So were you having these images in your head of this when you were playing the music?
Not yet. I had built these couple pieces, and then at that same time, the other members of the group said, TJ, this music is beautiful. We want to play it.
Yeah.
But I wanted to push in this other direction, and they said, I think we're going to leave you to do that. And it was a, you know, parting of ways that was really graceful and very
amicable.
Yeah. For everybody. Yeah. It was fine. And we're all good friends still, you know? And we still play together in various capacities, but I decided I'm moving on. This is a band. It's called Run Downhill. I already had the name from a previous experience that was really, you know, from my childhood. So I knew it was going to go on. And then I sat on this music, I'm generating this repertoire, and then I decided, okay, I'm going to make an EP.
Right.
And start building a music library. Because my mindset at the time was, I want to create music that will have a commercial application so that I can license it into commercial context.
Okay.
You know, for film, television, commercial settings, et cetera, license it out, and then start to build that library to earn mechanical royalties.
Yeah. I don't hear that often in this room.
Like, we call it mail money. We call it the money that arrives in the mail.
Sure.
And when, you know, like any entrepreneur, you have to start building passive income streams.
Yeah, for sure.
And when you can develop those, man, you're doing something really smart. You're doing something well for yourself.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
And that's also how you work towards career longevity.
Right.
In this industry, it's so
powerful. Yeah, you got to come up with super creative ideas to like sell this stuff and keep you doing what you love to do, right? Yeah.
So in putting together the artwork for that little EP that I was going to then start to shop for licensing purposes and build a catalog beyond it, et cetera, I talked with an artist. His name's Scott Engel. He's a friend of mine down in Los Angeles.
I recognize that name, too.
Scott, he drew Gumby, a lot of Gumby, for a lot of years. And then he worked
Gumby.
For the company. He worked for the company that was making all the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the original Turtles, t-shirts, toys, stickers, and so
really?
He was drawing a lot
of
that
those
stuff.
Toys were rad.
Yeah,
like,
dude.
There were so many moving parts on those toys. I loved it.
Both two of my friends, Eddie Young and Scott Engel, they still work with me and Run Downhill in various capacities.
Oh, cool.
Both those guys worked for that company, and all those t-shirts from the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
I know Eddie drew probably 200 or 300 of them.
Oh, wow.
Scott drew another handful, you know, a couple hundred maybe. You know, like those guys, I mean, they were working the entire time, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I asked Scott to do cover art, and then I told him the name Run Downhill and what that meant.
Yeah.
And as I told him that story, he just was, whoa, can I draw that story? I just want one picture. Let me draw that.
Well, let's talk about what Run Downhill means then. You've brought this up twice, and we haven't gone into it, so... well, actually, let's do this. Let's go with our second musical break. We're featuring music from Run Downhill that accompanies these amazing comic books, which you brought both issues of to me, which is awesome. I love getting free shit.
Right on, dude.
So let's do this. We'll go with our second musical break, and we'll be right back with more with special guest TJ Troy on the Air Raid Podcast. Stay with us.
Like the water of the sea.
what does run downhill mean?
The Cliff Notes version, run downhill means go to hell.
Okay. Long, I like that.
Long version.
Yeah.
I grew up in Wenatchee, Washington, which, right. as you know, is a horticulture town, primarily.
Yes.
You know, it's
yeah.
apples and cherries. It's
orchards. I thought you were going to say, which, as you know, is hell.
No.
No. It's not. It's a beautiful place.
It's a beautiful place. Now, if you want to talk about it, it breaks my heart that Wenatchee is as fire-prone as it is.
Oh, my God. Yeah. You know, and this season was bad.
It was awful.
Bad.
Awful,
yes.
Man.
Yeah. I have family over there, actually.
Yeah. And one of my good friends, a guy named Jake Gutzweiler, still lives over there. He lives up on Wenatchee Heights. He's a fourth-generation apple and cherry orchardist.
Uh-huh.
And I used to go up to his place as a kid. You know, you'd stay the night, stay the weekend, and just kind of hang out and play in his orchards and just have wilderness adventures.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
all boys should do, playing outside.
Yeah.
And across the street from his house was, you know, his stable area. They had pigs, they had cows, they had goats. You know, it was a farm. It was a farming family.
Yeah.
Past that stable area was a road, and the road wound out onto this hill, and the road was a series of cutbacks down this hill.
Uh-huh.
And apparently at the bottom of the hill was a wheat field. We never went down there. Jake told me once he went down there when he was really little, and he was so tired he couldn't make it back up. His dad finally came hunting for him with the
big
truck.
Hill.
Yeah.
Big hill.
Big
yes.
hill.
Okay.
While we're out there playing, Jake turns to me and says, "By the way, if the bull starts to chase you out here, just run downhill." I was like, "Are you fucking kidding me? There is a bull out here on this hill with us." And literally, dude, there's a 25-pound or 2,500-pound uncut bull that they just would let roam around there. And they owned it to, you know, rent out to other farmers basically to stud their cows.
Right,
when
right.
they wanted to have, you know, offspring from the cow, they would rent the bull out to it. So. But the bull's joints, he can outrun you on flat ground. They can reach, you know, 35, 30.
Yeah, they can't go downhill.
No, because their joints are too small.
Right, right.
And too brittle. So if you needed an escape route, you go down because he can't follow. And pretty soon he's going to get bored with you anyway.
Right, right.
And leave you alone.
Yeah.
And so that story just stuck with me. And as time went on, I sort of realized.
Did you ever have to run away from the bull?
No. We barely ever saw him. He's reclusive. He doesn't want to be bothered.
Yeah, yeah.
And who can blame him? You know, he's just living the life of Riley. You know what I'm saying?
Like I get to rented out to have sex.
Basically.
Like, yep.
I'm that good, baby.
Wow.
So that story just stuck with me. And when it came time to start this band, that was the name that just popped up. And that's where we are. So when I told Scott that story and he said, "Let me draw that."
Yeah.
I said, "Do it." 2 weeks later, this image arrives in my inbox and I look at it. And I've never had this happen to me before. I look at this and it was like a big bang moment, a flash of inspiration. If you open that book, you'll see it. It's on the...
It's not this one on the cover?
No, I'll show you.
Of just the legs hanging, which is obviously like a gallows.
That's still Scott's artwork.
Yeah.
But the image that we're talking about is this one here. And
this is going to be great for podcast too.
Yeah, the image
very
that they can't
very
see.
Very visual. Right. Yeah.
It's this one
here. Oh, holy shit.
And when he...
Oh, that's great.
That figure. Because I had this idea of there's a man on this hill.
Right.
And he's telling someone else, "You have to go down."
Right. So it's basically on a hill. It looks like it could be Wenatchee.
Yeah.
And there's a bull up at the top. He's not paying attention to these two men, these two young men. One is pointing downhill, saying that, yeah.
He's saying you have to go down. And so the other guy is looking at him. And the, you know, in my mind, I'm building this narrative. And why would I have to go to the bottom of the hill?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, because... That's the only way. You go back to Fight Club for just a second.
Sure.
Okay. And the notion behind Fight Club, Tyler Durden, Jack, you know, the Edward Norton schizophrenic character, his whole thing is he's trying to bottom out. He's trying to get to boilerplate.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Because it's only when you rock
bottom.
Because
then you can rebuild.
You can rebuild.
Yeah.
What's at the very bottom? It continues to descend. In other words, there is no bottom. There is no... boilerplate, because hell is always underneath.
Right.
And what's underneath that? It's another chasm underneath.
That's some super deep shit, dude.
And this was a point in my life that I was, you know, I was having to really consider this type of notion of, you know, how far down can it really go? Like, how much worse can it get?
What was going wrong, dude?
Oh, you know, you're always second-guessing yourself with a freelance career.
Career stuff,
You know, is this really doing what I need it to do right now?
Yeah,
is this
yeah.
helping me achieve the larger goals in my life? Like, you know, the goal in your life that you always set for yourself, I'm going to get this job.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, I'm going to meet that girl. And then we're going to get married. And then the children come along, and then pretty soon I've got my own house. And the notion of the American dream begins to evolve from there. And the, at the basis of that is it's your American dream.
When did you move to L.A.?
I moved in 1999.
1999?
To start a master's degree at CalArts.
Okay.
And I just decided to stay.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was a good city for me to pursue a career, especially with the skill set that I had. My skill set's very broad. And in the film and television industry, as a studio musician, it would make me very employable. Here's the shit thing, is that was at the peak of the exodus of work leaving Los Angeles. It had been picking up through the early 90s and in, you know, the late 90s and the early 2000s.
Like, are we talking especially like everything, like acting wise, entertainment wise, or are you just talking about kind of music,
the
music
wise, the music wise, the studio?
I don't know why I said music, but yeah.
Putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Right. Exactly.
You know, so much of that work has just left Los Angeles, and it's a steady stream.
Is it coming back?
It is.
Yeah.
You know, and what it takes for it to come back, first, understand why it left. It left because studios were no longer willing to allow money to flow freely to the subsidiary parts of a production.
Okay.
So music budgets were squeezed.
Right.
Okay.
You weren't getting people weren't getting points on production or anything
exactly.
like that.
So as those budgets get squeezed, then a composer, basically there came this concept of the all-in budget. You're going to write music for the film.
Yeah.
It's a feature film. It's called X-Men.
Yeah.
We're going to give you $650,000.
Right.
When you're done, we want a completed score. Thanks.
Yeah.
Come see us in a month. Okay.
Right.
Well, as a composer, you are now a production manager. You have to handle and produce this entire score.
You basically, you become a general contractor. You have to hire all these subs.
No, what you
to
do,
come in and
you
and do
hire
the
contractor to contract the musicians. You then hire the recording studio who's going to do, you know, produce the scoring sessions.
Okay.
And you're paying the engineer. You're paying the contractor who then pays the musicians.
Yeah.
And on and down the line. And somewhere in this budget that you were given is also your fee. You know, and composers need to make a living too. And and the contractors need to make a living. And so when you start to break these pieces up, it sounds like it's a ton of money. But when you actually start to break it up into, this is a 100-piece orchestra we're talking about for a film like that.
Yeah.
And everybody needs their wage. When these budgets start to get squeezed like this, then because of the bargaining agreements made through the musicians' union, saying things like, you must pay our musicians this much money.
Right.
And they need to have a 10-minute break every hour. And if it goes beyond 8 hours, you owe them time and a half.
Yeah.
And if it goes beyond this, you owe this. And if it does this, it does this. And there's these rules built in that the studios finally said, enough. Enough.
Yeah.
We're going to take this to Eastern Europe.
Right. We're going elsewhere.
They're going to go to another orchestra in Eastern
Europe. So was that when like things started to get a little dark?
Yeah, they changed.
For TJ Troy?
Well, I mean, it got dark for everybody. It's not just me. I'm part of a group of musicians who felt this squeeze.
Yeah.
And it was from people in generations above me, and it's especially present in younger generations. You know, I'm in the same pool as thousands of other musicians who
You're in
have
the same
skill
pool,
set.
Yes, and you're in the same pool in a place where people historically, you know, think of as being the American dream, right? As where you go to find that.
Right. And Los Angeles was one of those cities. The talent pool of musicians in Los Angeles is just extraordinary.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, it's
endless.
Some of the finest musicians in the world that you can call on the telephone and say, you want to have a jam?
Right.
Or can I take a lesson with you?
Yeah.
And that's what I did for many years.
And that must have been pretty exciting, right?
Very exciting.
Yeah.
To be able to connect with those guys. And work did start to change for me. You build relationships with people.
Right.
It's about that's how all these industries are going to work.
Yeah.
You build a relationship and they say, that guy's a stand-up guy. He's got the skill set. He shows up on time. You know, he's got the gear. And that's a big part of it, dude. Don't ever forget, you got to have the gear.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And that, you know, if you're a timpanist, man, you take out a loan. It's almost as much for your mortgage. Like a set of four concert timpani is in, you know, anywhere from 50
timpanis are the big copper kettle drums, like kettle drums.
Anywhere from $50,000 to $80,000.
Holy shit. Yeah.
If you're a timpanist and that's your career, how do you
fit that into a Honda Civic?
You don't. You hire a cartage company.
Yeah.
So again, back to the cost basis of what it actually takes
for all this stuff. Oh my God, man!
And so
I didn't even think about that. That's insane.
Most of the percussionists in town, at least in the heyday of the studio environment, most of the guys in town used a cartage service. Their gear was held at a warehouse. When they got a studio session gig, they'd call the cartage company and say, "I need crate A, C, and this bag of cymbals and this snare drum case, that has eight snare drums in it or whatever. I need that delivered to this studio at this time, set up for this scoring session."
Huh, no
and
kidding.
The cartage company would deliver that.
Yeah. And it's all your own equipment. It just stays in a warehouse until you're ready to go. Oh, that's funny.
So then when the session rolls in, you don't show up with your gear.
Right.
You show up and the gear is already set up because that's what you've paid those guys to do.
Right.
You know?
And they'll come in and like tune it for you and everything?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Now, here's the crazy thing is that at the height of the studio, what do I call it? At the height, the peak of this type of activity of where the music industry... This is the 70s is what I'm talking about. 70s and into the 80s. The cartage companies didn't bill the musician. They billed the studio, and the studios were happy to pay it.
Right.
Because it was a reasonable fee. And that's how the cartage companies stayed in business. So I didn't even pay, or if I was there at that time. I'm not there now, but... if I had my gear stored at one of these cartage facilities, they did not charge me to store it there.
Uh-huh.
When they delivered my stuff to this studio, they left a bill and said, "This is what you owe us for having delivered the gear." And then they come and pick it up and take it back to the warehouse.
Right.
And that was enough. That work agreement was enough to keep the cartage company in business. I got my fee. The studio got what they wanted. And man, that really worked for a long time. That was a beautiful system. And it was all unionized. So that also meant that the studios were paying into your health and welfare pension.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and retirement pension, et cetera, et cetera. It was a beautiful system. It's just what happened is, at a certain time, it expands. And like any economic bubble, it expands to a point where it no longer becomes a sustainable activity because on a cost basis, what do? You look to lower costs and increase profit.
Right.
And so when the studios decided that that was more of a priority than this level of quality that they were getting, that's when they said, "We're going to downsize. We're not paying for that cartage hit. You're going to do it." And so then the musician says, "Well, I got to charge more then." And so the composer says, "Well, if you're charging more, I can't hire you."
Right.
So then...
So it just all collapses.
It collapses.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're now picking up the pieces of a total collapse, man.
Right.
And now we're picking up the pieces. And it really, in my opinion, it rests on the shoulders of the composers.
Yeah. So how much work are you getting doing this?
And to clarify really quick, by resting on the shoulders of the composers, it's because they're the front line of the people going to talk to the studios.
Sure. Yeah.
And I always mention this because the composers, they're all my friends. They're, they're out to earn a living and to work within the industry, but I need them to be successful in order for me to be successful.
Sure. Yeah.
When the composers make a stance with the studio and they say, "I'm going to do everything in the box. All of this is going to be MIDI except for the percussion parts."
Right.
Or except for I'm going to bring in a string quartet and I want two percussionists to come and play these cues over here because nothing beats live percussion.
Yeah.
You know, samples and sample libraries, they're fantastic. And they've evolved to this point where you get wonderful music out of it, but it has a quality to it. And live percussion has another quality, and it's a pleasing quality.
Yeah.
So
does that scare you at all that stuff is getting better and better?
Yes and no. I mean, there are things that I do as a player that unless you are also a player, you cannot replicate.
Right.
So there's certain drums that I play, the North Indian tabla being one of them. A composer approaches me and they say, "I would like to sample you." And I say, "You can sample one sound at a time. I'm more than happy to play my sounds on it, but you can't sample my grooves."
Right.
Because the grooves that I play, you cannot reconstruct. Even if you take every single sound as an individual sound and you paste it together seamlessly as an edit, you can't do that the way that I play it.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you take my grooves and you sample them, I am putting myself out of work for that.
Right.
And that's a discussion that I have with every composer who approaches me and says, I want to record you playing tabla. I want to sample it. And I say, you can up to this limit.
Right.
Beyond that limit, I am
no longer
comfortable.
That's really
and
smart.
And sometimes I make friends doing that, and sometimes I don't make friends.
Yeah.
And sometimes I lose work. And,
and
that's a risk that I have to be willing to accept.
So you said earlier that you are basically kind of an independent contractor when it comes to playing this stuff. Mm-hmm. So you're not working for an actual, like, a company of musicians.
I'm not under contract.
So how did the Grammy come about? Because you are a Grammy winner.
Yes.
A Grammy winning percussionist.
Indeed.
Which is pretty impressive, dude. That's a large feat.
Man, it's one of the high points of my life, I tell you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I play with a group called Parch.
Okay.
And Parch is a West Coast group. Obviously, we're based out of Los Angeles. And we are recreating the music and the instrument collection of an American composer named Harry Parch.
Okay.
And Harry was a
now,
true
this is like
maverick.
Orchestral?
Well, I'm going to tell
music
you.
Music? Or, oh, okay.
This is where it gets fun. Ready?
Okay.
Harry Parch was very interested in the timbre qualities of the spoken voice, the human voice as we speak.
Okay, okay.
He really greatly disliked opera. He thought that was a bastardization of the human voice. It's not the way we should use our voice as an instrument. He wanted the inflection of the spoken voice. He hated opera. And he hated the institution of Western classical music, probably because they shunned him and they turned him away. So what he did in... He was studying tuning systems from ancient cultures, you know, ancient Roman and Greek cultures, all the way through to the modern era, and looking at the ways that they tuned instruments. I think people misunderstand that the piano is not the one and only way that notes should appear. Notes don't appear like that in nature.
Uh-huh.
And so if you look at it from pure sonic vibration, okay...
Well, this is going deep.
It is heavy. Again, like podcast, like visual breakdown right now.
This
Here's
is
my
most,
diagram.
By the way, this is the most nerdy I think we have ever got on this show. And I'm loving it. I'm absolutely
flattered.
Loving it.
I'm flattered.
Yeah.
Anyway, so to make the long story short, while we have 12 notes per octave on the piano, Harry Parch in that same space carved out 43.
Uh-huh.
43 microtones per octave.
Okay.
And so if you can imagine that, you can imagine then that Western instruments are not capable of producing these tones. Because our instruments are tuned tempered. It's a tempered tuned guitar that you play. It's a tempered tuned piano that you play. 12 even tones per octave. And he said no. He created a map of 43 tones per octave, and then he needed to invent instruments to play them.
Yeah.
So... Hence, his famous quote was, I was a composer seduced into carpentry. Because he had to begin building these things. And he started out by building an adapted viola.
Okay.
He took the body of a viola and he attached the neck of a cello on it. And then he put this colored diagram. It's almost like a tablature sort of system underneath it to find these pitches. And... then he started composing this music, and
he built... So he built all these different instruments, like that's just one of many,
I'm guessing. There's about 26, 29 or something like that, that he invented.
That's cool.
And they are true works of art. They're museum pieces, practically. The beautiful part about it is they are now housed at the University of Washington.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
For many years, they moved around the country. Uh-huh. He passed away in the mid-70s, Harry.
Okay,
did.
Okay.
And he had several different music directors that he had trained, and he said finally at his death that you should take possession of the instruments. It was a man named Dean Drummond.
Uh-huh.
And Dean first had a position at, I think this was first, I could be wrong, the music director of Parch is the real expert, so I'm trying to reproduce things to the best of my recollection. But SUNY Purchase, State University of New York in Purchase, housed the instruments for many years.
Okay.
A new dean came to SUNY and said, I don't want this crazy crap around me anymore. Get rid of it. And he fired him.
That's weird shit.
Yeah. No, I take that back. It was first at San Diego State University.
Okay.
And Danley Mitchell had them, and then... they came to Dean Drummond. Dean took
but
them
these
away
were,
from
but
San
these
Diego.
Are but these are like museum pieces. So how did you guys get into playing these things?
We've been systematically recreating the instruments.
No shit.
We've been
rebuilding them. So did you have to? You have to, like, everybody in this group, like, start like learning how to build this stuff?
We don't build them ourselves. Okay. We contract artisans and master instrument builders. And Harry published a book, thank God, called Genesis of a Music.
And how to like, play these things?
It was basically a blueprint of it.
So what were you playing then? What was the instrument that you were tasked with figuring out?
My instrument is a bass marimba.
Okay.
And
marimba is almost, it looks like a xylophone, but it's enormous.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, this is even bigger. It stands about 6 feet tall. Yeah. It's about as big as your car, dude. The bass marimba is about as big as your car. The biggest key on it is a solid piece of spruce. It's about 5 feet long.
Yeah.
And
how thick is that?
It's like 6 inches wide. It's an inch and a half thick piece of solid spruce, man.
That's insane.
There's 11 keys on this instrument. I stand on a bench. I mean, I'm 6'5". I stand on a bench to play the thing, you know?
Oh, it's tall, too. It's like tall.
It's tall.
Oh, wow.
Because underneath it, we have repurposed church organ pipes to become the resonator tube. So the resonators, the biggest one is about 5.5 feet long. And there's a mathematical formula.
I remember
the
first time I saw a marimba being played, it was at Central Washington University.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the music students. You know, they would do the concerts and stuff for their professor, thesis or something like that.
The professor at Central.
Holy smokes, dude.
He was really heavily recruiting me out of high school to
come
to Central.
Oh, really?
And
no
I
kidding.
Almost did because I liked him so much.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I chose
it was
another
impressive,
avenue.
Man. Yeah. Like, I was super impressed. I had no idea what a marimba was at that point, but I was very impressed.
It's a very athletic style of playing.
Yeah.
So the bass marimba I play on a variety of different mallets. I use big gong mallets. Uh-huh. I use my hands sometimes.
Right.
I use small
How long did it take you to figure this thing out? Was it much different than what you were used to playing?
It's not much different.
No? No, okay.
It's really not.
It's just more keys.
It's fewer keys, actually.
Oh,
it's only 11 keys on the instrument. On my instrument, there's only 11, whereas a concert marimba would have probably, about 60 some.
So we're talking about the slats of wood that you pound on.
They're, 6 inches wide. They're giant. You know, they're big things.
Just enormous.
5 feet long, 6 inches wide, and there's 11 of them stretched probably across an 8-foot frame.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing.
So our instruments, the beauty of them is that they are transportable, and they're road ready.
Uh-huh.
And they were inexpensive enough to build from raw materials that if something breaks, we can also repair them.
Okay.
Now, that's not to say that we don't take great care of the instruments
really
build them correctly. We do. And our music director, John Schneider, has taken enormous care in the cultivation of this new instrument collection. So fast forward now to the record. The record from last year is called Plectra and Percussion Dances.
Uh-huh.
And it's a triptych of compositions from Harry that he always intended to be choreographed with dancers.
Yeah.
So the first piece, Castor and Pollux, the middle movement, Ring Around the Moon, the final movement, a piece called Even Wild Horses.
Yeah.
And all of these are multi-movement works. Altogether, it's over an hour worth of music, or maybe just under an hour worth of music.
Okay.
And we were the first group to actually take the three together and put them as an album called Plectrum Percussion Dances with this group of pieces together.
That's awesome, man.
And that's what Harry always wanted to do. Yeah. He talked about it. He wrote about it.
Is this available online somewhere? Can people listen to this?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
It's probably on iTunes and every place else, but it's available off of Bridge Records. Bridge Records is a New York
really cool.
record company.
That's really cool. And so you guys ended up winning a Grammy for this album.
We were nominated.
How did that feel?
Well, like I said, it's the most amazing feeling of my life, man.
Yeah.
We were nominated in two categories, small chamber music or small ensemble chamber music performance, I think is the name of the category.
Yeah.
And the second one was Best Classical Compendium, which is kind of the de facto album of the year in the classical world. We won Best Classical Compendium. The other one went to a violinist, Hilary Hahn.
Yeah.
And we kind of knew that. She's an amazing musician, and we sort of knew, she's kind of just that good,
Our
record's really good, but this is Hilary Hahn. She's an amazing musician. And that did go to her.
Yeah.
And then we're sitting there, we got tickets to go to the Grammys and we're sitting there in this ceremony and, you wear a tuxedo and we're there with the group all in our aisle together. And I just had a feeling. I said, this one's coming home to us.
You wear a tuxedo unless you're Kanye West and then wear like an oversized brown t-shirt.
Man, musicians have every right to be as eclectic and
I don't
show
even
that personality, man.
Yeah, totally.
Like, be who you are and enjoy it and own it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just happened to have a brand new tuxedo at the time, and I wanted to sport it, man. I wanted to feel good about it, you know?
Yeah, you got to use that shit.
And they announced our name, and first thing I do is just, yeah! And the people around me are like, oh, who's this guy? So you get to go up on stage. And
yeah,
our,
yeah.
You know, John, our music director, gives, you know, the most beautiful acceptance speech.
Uh-huh.
And we're just sitting there, and all you want to do is grab the people next to you and just hug them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is, you know, one of those moments that you thought you could do,
yeah,
but you had to earn that moment.
Oh, for sure.
And so for the years of practice, the years that you spent alone in the practice room and you didn't date girls, right? And the years that you spent not eating maybe as well as you could have if you had a different job.
Yeah.
You know, if you have that full-time job and you're taking care of everything and your bases are all covered, that's awesome. But, man, this is a lifestyle. It's a way of life. And with the students that I work with and the people that I talk to about it, you know, percussion, drumming, it's not your hobby. It's not the thing that you love to do. It is the way that you live.
Yeah.
And you either embrace that lifestyle or you choose something else to do with yourself. But if you're going to take it, you need to own it.
I like that.
You own the pitfalls that come with it. And then when you earn those successes, they also belong to you. And handle those with grace.
Yeah.
You know, and
for sure.
So here we are at this time when that's finally coming home and it's placed in our hands and you get the award. And you go backstage, and from there begins a series of media obligations.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a handler comes out, and they say, you're going to come with us, and they take you to a series of rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You walk into a room, and there's 50 journalists sitting behind laptops, and they ask you questions. Okay, Parch, classical compendium. Who's Harry Parch? What is this music about? What is microtonal music? You know, how does it feel to win a Grammy? You know, like, what does the record sound like? The same questions that you would ask me, except they're coming rapid fire from everybody.
Right, right, yeah.
And you've got
a minute to basically put this thing into a nice little box.
Yeah. You know, they want to hear from you so that they can report in, you know, all the major, you know, music publications and whatnot.
Sure, sure.
And then you go on to the next one, and here's the online media. Here's the print media. Here's newspapers. Here's magazines.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you walk into a room and it's 50 photographers all on like bleacher seats.
Uh-huh.
And literally they've got these giant professional cameras like over here, over here, over here. Click, click. Thank you.
Yeah.
Over here. Eyes here, please. And everyone is just shouting at you. And you're like, looking here and looking here, looking here. And man, by the end of the day, your face is tired because you've been smiling because you can't wipe this smile off your face.
Oh,
now.
Sure. Yeah.
And then they tell you, they say, now you have your tickets to the telecast, which is the big show.
Uh-huh. Right?
They say, we suggest you go get something to eat now.
Yeah,
because this is a long day.
Uh-huh.
You know, the concert's 4.5 hours long, or maybe 3.5 or something like that.
Right, right.
And so they tell you, go get something to eat, you know, take some downtime.
Yeah.
Enjoy your afternoon and
we'll
see you
drinks.
At the concert.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do what you want to do. Yeah. And then you have, you know, your Willy Wonka golden ticket to get into the telecast. And if you got the right seats, which you just have to answer back in RSVP in a timely fashion, which we did. And they put us maybe 200 feet away from the stage.
Oh, nice.
And I got to tell you, like, that's some bucket list shit, man.
Yeah.
Like, I got to see Paul McCartney play.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Like, check that off the list. I saw a Beatle, and he was that close to me that I can see his face. And the Paul McCartney, you know, you know, he's just got the Beatle face on, and you're like,
man,
it's really him. And then Annie Lennox walked on stage and she just destroyed everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and Beck was my favorite performer on that stage that night.
Was this last year?
Yeah. Just last year.
Yeah.
Or this year, actually, February of this year, 2015.
Oh, okay.
So for the release.
I didn't
release,
know it was that recent. Oh, my God. Okay.
The release period of 2014.
Right,
from,
right.
You know, year 2014, basically, and then the award ceremony being early 2015.
Yes.
This,
okay.
This
okay.
is the awards.
Well, that is amazing, man. And what a great way to end this episode, too.
Yeah,
so,
dude.
TJ Troy, thank you so much for stopping by the backyard.
You bet, man.
This has been a lot of fun.
Likewise. Aaron, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And the comic book is called Spurs?
Comic book, the title of the book is Run Downhill.
Run Downhill.
Same as the band.
Okay.
The story that we're telling is called Spurs, and the issue we've just released is Spurs number 2.2.
Yeah.
It's a 24-page book with two chapters in it, and then it comes with a 7-song EP. And
download code.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, indeed. And in the 20 years I've been a musician, man, this is the best record that I've made. I feel really strongly about it. And I just hope that we reach some folks here, and people want to take this record home with them, man.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. So yeah. Check it out. Go to tjtroy.com, and you can find out more and how to get your hands on copies of this right there. So,
and you can check out rundownhillmusic.com as well.
Awesome. Check that out. Awesome. Yeah. Okay, buddy.
Aaron, thanks so much, man. It's a great pleasure, dude.
Yeah.
Great pleasure.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Likewise.
All right. I know that I've had maybe 3 or 4 glasses of wine. I have lost count. And I don't want to toot my own horn, but man, we have had quite a few Grammy winners on this show now. That's pretty great. You guys don't have to think it's great, but I'm pretty happy about it. I'm pretty happy about it. DJ Troy, everybody, of the band Run Downhill and the comic book Spurs, which you can get now. They're working on I believe they're working on the third installment of this here thing, the comic book and the album to accompany it. So go to rundownhillmusic.com. I don't see any upcoming shows on their website, but stay in touch. Stay in touch with them, will you? TJ Troy, everybody. What a pleasure. What an absolute pleasure. All right, I'm going to get back to packing for Palm Springs to go stay in a retirement community for a week. I just realized how ridiculous that sounds, and I am so excited. I am so excited. So are my kids, man, my whole family. We are very excited to get the hell out of here. Okay, you can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes, and if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. It only takes a second to give us a little star rating, and helps out. Helps out a lot, actually, in the long run. We're also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, and Cairo Radio apps for your mobile device. And now on the Adore Network at Spreaker, and Spreaker's got an app as well, so you can check it out there. Or just visit www.air-raid.net to subscribe directly to the RSS feed, which is going to change in a week, folks. So go to Spreaker and subscribe there, or just wait for a week and then don't get the show and then subscribe late, okay? All right, keep in touch by liking our Facebook page at facebook.com/theairraidpodcast. That's where we update stuff all the time and let people know what's going on. Our Twitter handle is @airraidnet, which we also update all the time, so, and post things there. Maybe funny things or, you know, songs that are coming out from bands we like. So follow us on Twitter, people. Or email me directly at Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, @air-raid.net. And remember to take the pledge, folks. Take the pledge to tell somebody about this show. Bring it up in conversation. Subscribe your mom to it while she's not looking. And make sure she downloads it every week, okay? All right. That's how we gain new listeners. From people, from unsuspecting victims. All right, we're going to go out this week with another song by Run Downhill that accompanies these awesome comic books, which you should definitely check out. This one is called How Can You Weep? Thank you so much for listening this week, everybody. We really appreciate you guys tuning in week after week to check out this here podcast, okay? And also, archives are still available at air-raid.net. You can listen to episodes with people like Mike McCready of Pearl Jam, Duff McKagan, founding member of Guns N' Roses, tons and tons of indie bands that you should definitely know about, and amazing comedians as well, and directors and actors and all sorts of people, authors. Oh, man, it's all there for your listening pleasure, so go and check it out. Man, I need to stop drinking. I think that's what needs to happen. Okay. This is How Can You Weep by Run Downhill. Oh, man. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week. Palm Springs!